Okay.
Do we have any
regular white chalk to write with?
This is not regular.
No, this one has a piece. That has a piece.
Yeah, but these. Yeah. Yeah, they look like trash. This is fine.
This is also regular white chalk.
Okay. Probably a more appropriate title for this talk should have been "Can Null Time End?" rather than "Time," but hopefully you'll forgive the slight boosting and allow me to actually pretend that null time is actually like time. So this is going to be based on work that I did with Ben Krafts, who's in Amsterdam, myself, and Eric Belinde. And this is work that's already appeared in HEP Theory 05061180. And depending on the time, if time does or doesn't end, we'll hopefully get to some more recent work, which is going to appear with my student, Daniel Robbins. Okay, so let me give you a little bit of an outline for how I want to organize the talk. So I'm going to start with some background and motivation. I think this talk is going to have a very different flavor from some of the talks recently, so perhaps we'll shift gears a little and think about some cosmological issues. Then I'll describe for you what is probably the simplest cosmological background you could imagine in string theory, a really simple string background. We'll come to realize that this string background, even though it's very simple as a solution of supergravity, a solution of string theory, it's still very hard to understand, and we'll need some alternative description, which will lead us to a matrix Big Bang. That's the beginning of time. And then in the last part of the talk, again, depending on time, we'll come to a different kind of model that gives us a matrix Big Crunch. That's sort of the more recent work. Okay, so let me just begin with a little background, motivation. So in string theory, we've had enormous success in understanding a very special class of singularities, of time-like singularities. So we've been able to resolve a large class of time-like singularities, and the resolutions have come about in very different ways. So the simplest examples that we're all familiar with are things like strings on, say, the complex plane, mod Z2, perturbative strings, where we're just order holding. This, of course, is a two-dimensional code. And while point particle quantum field theory would have problems on such a code, string theory doesn't have problems because of additional sectors in the string Hilbert space, which are just coming about from these twisted sectors. So the existence of twisted sectors mean that the string renders this space finite, or string theory on this space is rendered finite, or smooth. So this is purely an effect. It doesn't involve any G-string corrections. It's in effect strictly an alpha prime. Sort of the simplest example of string theory resolving a singularity. There are, of course, higher dimensional analogs that we're all familiar with. But the physics changes a little. For example, if we took C2 mod C2, in this situation, string theory just doesn't see a singular geometry as long as there's a B field. So from the perspective of the string well sheet, as long as there's some B field going through that fixed point of that action, we get a desynchronization. Again, a degree of freedom you don't see in classical relativity. First part of this is very elementary. So, if we make that geometry honestly singular, for example, by tuning the B field to zero through that fixed point, then, as we know, perturbative string theory will break down. So, in this situation, perturbative string theory breaks down, but string theory is still finite as long as we include non-perturbative effects. In this case, we think of blowing up this fixed point a little bit. We can, of course, wrap it some D-brain on this state, D-brain on this cycle. And the inclusion of this D-brain state of 1 over G string effect again leads to a finite non-perturbative string theory. So this thing is becoming massless as we shrink down. So we might hope that in a similar way, string theory is going to resolve for us very simple cosmological singularities. And the first thing I want to argue for you is that that doesn't happen. So, at least, can these mechanisms work for cosmology? I think, at least to date, the answer is no. Every case that we study of orbifold type or any other solvable cosmological background, we always run into the problem that both perturbative string theory and any attempt to include non-perturbative effects directly tend to give us something of this kind, say D-brains, condensing, tend to give us a singular theory. So we need something a little... question? So we're going to need something a little different to understand what's going on. And the basic reason is the following. Just imagine some kind of space-time with a curvature singularity. So you look at some scattering experiment, say two gravitons scattering, two scalar fields, whatever you want to scatter. And as you approach that curvature singularity, which you will always approach, the energy is blue shifting, and as the energy is blue shifting, your effective G Newton, which is controlling gravitational interactions, is diverging. So in the setup, because of blue shift effects, G Newton effective always diverges. And in that situation, no duality will really help you in controlling the physics, because all of our dualities tend to keep the Einstein frame metric fixed. So if G Newton is diverging in Einstein frame, it's diverging in every U-dual frame, say. So string duality is not going to help us in understanding the physics of strong gravity. So that's the question I want to try to get some handle on today. We're going to need a very different formulation to actually get control over the physics of a cosmological singularity.
What about the proposal of Silberstein? What about the proposal of Silberstein?
So their proposal, the idea that in a certain class of spacetimes a tachyon could condense before you reach a singularity, to me is a way of cutting it out of the spacetime. Mm-hmm. So there are many ways of resolving a singularity. We'll see some of them later in perturbative string theory. For example, if you have a singularity coming from a fixed point, you couple it with a shift and the action becomes free and you lose the singularity. So to me it's more along those lines. What I'm really interested in is what is actually happening in the strong gravity region. I'm not trying to get rid of it. I want to actually understand something about the physics of that region. And I think, you know, the tachyon condensation seems like a complicated way of doing a kind of, adding a kind of shift to the story. I don't really have much more to say about that proposal. Okay. So what kinds of examples have people studied? Well, there's one that's going to be very relevant for us. Well, the simplest solvable string theories are all of this overfold kind. So naturally, people try to do cosmological versions of overfolding. So people looked at, for example, R11, this mod Z. So we have a metric, which I'll write in my colon, like that. And we'll identify by boost. This spacetime is called either Meissner space. The Meissner space refers to different things depending on where you look, or the Lorentzian overfold. That's probably a better terminology. So it's a nice overfold. If we look in spacetime, it has different sectors. So, for example, in this quadrant, x plus x minus a positive, you have something, you have a sector which looks like Milne space, which I'll come to in one moment. In the backward sector, it again looks like Milne. And these side wedges look like Rindler, sort of two-dimensional analogs of Rindler space. And these are sort of Rindler wedges. So let's change variables to just make the identification more apparent. So if we go to these coordinates, the metric takes a form. It's all nice because it's all in two dimensions. You can really get your hands on the physics. And there's an identification because of this overfolding, which makes x periodic. So in this Milne region,
Sorry,
it's 1 over root 2. T e to the plus minus x. It's a T. So this x circle is shrinking and shrinking down to sort of a Big Bang point. And then if you just go forward in time, it just expands out to infinity. That's this Milne space. So you can think of this Milne space as sort of a mini Big Bang, if you wish, starting from this x plus equals 0 point and just propagating forward with the circle expanding. So it's very natural to say, okay, I have an overfold. Let me use my standard prescription for string theory on an overfold, or maybe modify it a little bit. It's an infinite dimensional overfold. I have to worry about normalizations, taking the right wave functions, and so on. But this was studied by, say, these authors, Bakuz, Ben Krafts, Kutasov, and Rajesh. And what they found is if you looked at four-point scattering in this background, say the four-point amplitude of tachyons with some momentum, they found that this amplitude is divergent for generic kinematics. So you find divergences, and those divergences, when you look at this tree-level amplitude, can be associated with large graviton exchange near this singularity. So it's really what's causing all of the problems here is large back reaction from the exchange of gravitons near the singularity. And this kind of problem, I think, is just going to be there in almost any situation where you try and use perturbative string theory to study a singularity of this kind. So you have divergences across, let's say, graviton exchange. Near the singularity.
So they
a well, this can be embedded in any dimensional string theory you want. You just need a two-dimensional subspace, this R11, right? You can put it in critical string theory and just treat it as an overfold. Now, I should stress that this is a divergence that you see at tree level. So, for example, you might wonder if twisted sectors running in loops could help you or any other approach like that, but that's going to be difficult because unless string perturbation theory breaks down, you need something that actually contributes at tree level. Whereas twisted sectors would contribute in one loop, running in pairs. But they won't help you with this kind of divergence. So, we're left with this very basic problem of how are we going to address questions like, can time begin? Can time end? Can we go through a Big Bang singularity? Is there a pre-Big Bang scenario? What is actually happening? And it appears that any kind of space-time effective picture is going to break down. Any picture that involves graviton exchange or gravitons as fundamental degrees of freedom near this kind of curvature singularity is likely to be bad. So we will need some other description in which gravitons are not fundamental. So our attempt will center on holography. Can we actually use holography to get a very different picture of the physics that we would hope would be perturbative in this regime near the singularity? Okay. That's a little background and motivation. So actually what we need is a very simple model, which where we can actually get our hands on what's actually happening and write down some kind of dual description that we can work with. So that will be our aim. So just so that it's not confusing later, let me stress, in this discussion we're talking about string theory with Milne or this Lorentzian orbifold as a target space. Milne will make an appearance for us momentarily in a very different guise, which has nothing to do with target space physics. Okay. Well, we know from past experience that holography for cosmological spaces is going to be unusual, meaning that the dual theory is likely to be non-local. And yes.
If you have more dimensions, did any of your discussion, the results of your discussion change? I mean, if you go up to 4 to 10?
This basic problem of having the breakdown of string perturbation theory doesn't really change, no. It doesn't matter what dimensions you append to it. So these are calculations you could have done in the bosonic string. It wouldn't have mattered. Actually.
In other words, if x is really an angular variable, so if you replace it by a sphere.
Oh, sorry, you want to generalize Milne to something else.
Yeah, can you do that?
You certainly can do that, and it, you know, unless it can be presented as an orbifold, it would be hard to study exactly in string theory. You'd have to solve for some CFT.
If you replace, I mean, basically this is, t is acting like a radial variable in polar coordinates.
Yeah.
So you could do spherical polars where you analytically continue r to t.
Well, you won't get a solution. Well, for t of this one, you won't get a solution of general relativity that way. Right. I mean, you have to find a solution of string theory. And just replacing x by a high dimensional sphere.
Won't that still be flat?
No, I don't think so.
It's
two-dimensional. It has to be two-dimensional to be flat, right? I mean, you can find high-dimensional analogs of Milne and try and study them, but I think the basic intuition should be that you're always going to run into the same kind of problem, that locally you're going to have large graviton exchange and a singularity, and you're going to have a divergence at tree level. But it's certainly not a proven statement, but I would be really surprised if it were not true. Like, you could find some string background where it actually worked. You got a finite result. Again, barring issues of trying to condense a tachyon before you got to the singularity or something. But that's, again, excising that region, so you don't see it. Okay. So, what we need is a simple example that is tractable. So why don't we start with flat space? Flat space doesn't seem too exciting. So let's take a string background. Let me take my 10-dimensional metric to be precisely flat. Nice string background. We've all studied it at some point. We know how to quantize the string in it. Because not much is happening in this case. So we'll modify it just slightly. Instead of taking a constant string coupling, we'll allow our dilaton, phi, to vary with x plus. So x plus is null time. So we're going to have a light-like linear dilaton in this setup. Now,
what's this?
That's
Q.
So Q right now is a parameter. Q itself doesn't really have any invariant meaning because if I boost, like that, I can change the value of Q to any non-zero value. So all that really matters is that Q should be either zero or non-zero, as long as phi is light-like. So I can, for example, just scale Q to be one. We'll keep Q in there, for it's kind of useful as a counting parameter. Well, this is, I claim, a solution of perturbative string theory. A very, very simple solution. You can find it in some guys in Polchinski Volume 1, I think. Let's see what's actually happening in space-time. Well, to see what's happening in space-time, we should go to Einstein frame. So we should go from string frame to Einstein frame. And on doing so, we see that the Einstein frame metric now has a scale factor, which depends on x plus. And in particular, as we take x plus to minus infinity, which is going to be our big bang point, if you wish, the metric is shrinking down to zero size. So it's really an expanding space-time, starting with, so it kind of looks like, I don't know how to draw it, but as x plus propagates forward, there's sort of a big bang, if you wish. And that's precisely the region where the string coupling is big. So the string coupling is large near the big bang and gets weaker and weaker as we propagate forward in null time. So in this region here, we have weakly coupled strings. This is a weak coupling. You can, of course, reverse this by reversing the sign of Q, if you wish, and have it start in the weak coupling region and then propagate into a big crunch where perhaps time will end. This is actually not going to be my big crunch model. Well, let's view this as a big bang model for the moment. So, why is this a solution of string theory? Well, if we recall from Polchinski, the contribution to the central charge from a linear dilaton of this kind depends on the direction in which you point the linear dilaton. So you pick a vector in space-time, and you get a contribution which goes like the norm of the vector, which in this case, where we pick the null direction, is actually zero. So flat space is a solution with a null linear dilaton. It's perhaps the simplest cosmological or time-dependent solution that we could have imagined. So, again, this is a solution in which perturbative string theory is good at late times and breaks down near the singularity.
How about supersymmetry?
We'll come to supersymmetry. But right now, let's just worry about, say, the bosonic string on this background, which we can certainly do. So, because this is perturbative at late times, we can certainly quantize our strings at late times and compute the spectrum. And we can ask, how does it change from standard free quantization? And it changes in a very simple way. Namely, if we do perturbative string quantization, actually, one thing I find remarkable is that people studied space-like choices for V, which we all know and love, things like the NS five-rank solution, and there was even a lot of study of time-like solutions. But nobody actually had bothered to look at the null solution, which was sort of left out. But it turns out to be quite interesting. So let's just take the bosonic string, which is good enough to do string quantization, same d dimensions. So we just have some free scalars, x mu, and the only modification that this not linear delta makes, it's to the stress tensor, which just gets modified by a sweetening term, if you wish, a q d squared x plus. But that's the only change. The central charge is still d, and this parameter q is just that free parameter we were using to specify the string background. So if we quantize in this background and we want to construct vertex operators, they take the conventional form, e to the I p mu x mu times some polynomial and derivatives of the x mu's. Oops. Your choice. Where the polynomial has left-right scaling dimension n. For the scaling dimension, total scaling dimension. So we can construct physical states sort of in the usual way, but there's a small change. Namely, when we look at L0, we're going to find a small imaginary, well, not necessarily small, we're going to find an imaginary contribution. P plus, P minus, plus this imaginary IQ, plus any oscillator contribution. And this piece is non-standard. But it's easy to understand where it's coming from. If we look at the zero-mode part of our vertex operator, we usually normalize with a factor of g string times our wave function. And usually we don't worry about that factor of g string because it's just some constant that sits in front of your vertex operator. But in this case, our g string depends on x plus. So the effect of this IQ piece is going to be to compensate for the fact that we have a time-dependent g string. So here we can't neglect this. So our psi will take the form e to the ipx plus p upper plus x, x upper plus minus, minus this extra piece, e minus iq x plus. No, this is actually set up so that this will actually cancel the time depends in front of g string. Yeah, when you put it. So this will come in with a. So this will go like e to the minus qx plus, and this will give us a plus qx plus.
Is this conventional looking by p minus?
Right, so, good. So the way to think about it is that the Lycone energy e minus is defined in this case to be p minus plus this iq. And that's the measure. So then when we write down Machel condition, the effective m squared for such a mode is 2p plus e minus minus the momentum squared. And that, of course, should be compensated by the oscillator piece. Okay. So actually, classical evolution in this background is very easy. Let's just go to space-time and look at classical evolution.
Wait a minute. Isn't there a problem with what is, so the effective mass is complex? No, I mean, there's an inconsistency, right? 4n minus 1 is manifestly real, and the thing you've written there...
No, p minus.
Oh, p minus is complex.
Yes, okay. Yes. So p minus is unconventional, but e minus will be conventional. So the Lycone energy will still have its physical meaning, and then we have a complex momentum. Okay, so let's just look for a second at, say, some scalar field in space-time. This will give us another interpretation of the same business. with say mass m, Lagrangian governing this field is nice. It's just minus the mass square term. And if you look at the equation of motion and you solve for a classical solution, you'll find that this tachyon has a piece that goes like e to the minus qx plus times sort of a standard contribution. So that's the only change for the propagation of a scalar field with the relation minus 2 p plus e minus plus p squared plus m squared vanishes as our Maxwell condition. Okay. Well, let's now embed this in type 2a. So quantization is easy in a weak coupling regime. There's no problems at all in understanding what's going on. All of our problems are going to be in the strong coupling regime. So if we want to embed in 2a, we should now ask about supersymmetry, as Cameron just asked about. So for the choice, phi going like x plus, dilaton going like x plus, we should ask how many supersymmetries are preserved in such a background. So we look at the Suzy variations of the gravitino, the dilatino, and we ask where is there a coupling to the dilaton that we have to worry about. And the only place that a coupling appears is via the dilatino variation, which takes this form, epsilon. But that's the only coupling. So, to count the number of unbroken supersymmetries, we need to ask ourselves how many solutions are there to the equation gamma plus epsilon equals zero, and there are 16 solutions. We call that squared to zero. This is very nice. This is a half BPS solution for string theory. Now, because it's half BPS, we intuitively expect the metric not to receive quantum corrections. So we should be able to use the lift to M theory, the naive lift to M theory, to determine the strong coupling limit of this metric without corrections. So this is sort of crucial for controlling the physics as we go back toward this strong coupling region where the Big Bang originated. Because in that region, the string coupling is getting big, and we should really lift it. So as G-string gets large, we go to M theory, and
that's not obvious, the statement you're making. I can imagine some having for half a PS for an energy transformation law, or higher Lyrical terms or something, you might be extra terms, possibly, which would then change the condition, and you might have to get corrections. It's not obvious that we should have no corrections in the middle.
Okay, so there's certainly high derivative corrections, and those are there and will be relevant to what's happening. What I would have said is that at the level of renormalization of the... So there's a naive metric that you write down in M theory. And if you ask yourself, can that thing be renormalized? Intuitively, half BPS solutions typically don't get renormalized. So that's sort of the intuition. That doesn't mean that half BPS solution... doesn't mean that metric determines for you a background where you can just do graviton scattering, for example. So quantum mechanically...
What does it mean when you say it doesn't renormalize? I don't understand.
So I would say that it determines for you some solution of M theory. I mean, it's a way to characterize a particular solution of M theory. Yes. What do I mean by this?
Sorry, what?
Let him make some claim, you know, with a slightly ridiculous knowledge.
No, he did make a claim already. I just wanted
to
make the claim that it's not being normalized.
I guess what the claim would be that the higher curvature terms won't change the metric.
Won't change the metric, right.
It'll still be a solution even in the presence of
right.
the curvature.
Right. No, I know that's what he claimed. I'm just trying to understand how he knows this thing. That's my question.
I want to say you can prove sort of a Suzy normalization theorem here with any metric with half supersymmetry. That's right. That's right.
You're hoping, or you know, that you're just saying maybe.
I know it's true for time-like standard supersymmetries. With null supersymmetries, I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
But intuitively, I would think it's the case. But it's something that actually needs to be shown.
Okay.
That's definitely true.
As long as you don't think things obvious.
No. It's actually unproven, I would say, at this point. But it's something that should be provable from a supergravity analysis. So, let's lift this to 11 dimensions in the usual way. So we're going to get flat space plus this extra 11th direction, which I'll call y, and they just come in with scale factors where phi now depends on x plus. Right, so just remember phi minus q x plus here. So let's try to understand what's going on with this solution. Naively, it might appear that there are two singularities. So as we go back in time, x plus going to minus infinity, this factor is blowing up. No, I have it wrong. X plus goes to minus infinity, this factor is blowing up, and this is blowing down. So that's one singularity. But you might think, if we go the other way, forward in time, the same thing might be true. I said that in a confusing way, I bet. Okay. Let me just make a clearer statement. Okay. So the claim is that this space-time is geodesically incomplete. And that there is a singularity at finite distance in the far past. And there's no singularity at finite distance in the far future. So to see this, let's just look at some geodesic. For example, let's just take x minus to be constant, xi to be constant, and consider the geodesic equation to get an affine parameter. For a metric of this form, this is the only non-vanishing Christoffel symbol that we have to worry about, and this is just constant, 2q over 3. So we can integrate this to get an affine parameter. Lambda, which is of this form, and we can express the metric nicely in terms of this parameter, minus 3 over q, d lambda dx minus, plus lambda dx 8 squared. So lambda is morally our time coordinate, if you wish. And when we look at curvatures, what we see is that these components of the Riemann tensor are the only interesting ones, lambda y, and these are diverging as lambda goes to zero. These are diverging. So there are actually no curvature invariants that diverge. If you want to construct scalar curvature or something, that will not diverge, that will vanish in this case. But the tidal forces which come about from this Riemann tensor are blowing up. So you're getting ripped apart as you go back in time toward the Big Bang. So there's an honest-to-goodness singularity here at lambda equals zero, which is what we want to see. So this model, this background should serve as a nice toy model. It's about as simple as we could get for a Big Bang. So far, so good? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, you could. Yeah, so you could ask yourself, are there going to be quantum corrections of some kind that would modify the metric in such a way that this was finite, for example? And I suspect, yeah, good. So we certainly haven't proven it, but I strongly suspect that there can't be any quantum corrections to the metric per se in this case. I think the proof will be very analogous to the proof for standard time-like supersymmetries. But that remains to be shown. So we took that as granted, that there is actually going to be interesting strong curvature physics that we have to worry about here as we go back in the far past.
Even asking that question is a bit ambiguous. How do you probe this question by some scattering or whatever? The notional space sum should break down by the time you get to that region. So even the question about whether this is normalized or not is a bit
Right. Okay. Yeah, it would be a formal question about the possible dependence of the supergravity metric on Dilaton or something. Yeah, something along those lines. But it's certainly true that in actuality, what will happen is the physics will change drastically long before you get there.
Talk about metrics.
Yeah, I agree. See, what you would need to actually resolve this with some kind of quantum correction, what you would need is some effects that will render G Newton finite as you go back in time.
So and all we can say is that for large enough lambda, whether or not there is going to be any small corrections to this or not, that you could check.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
If you say there's no correction there, then you can take it as a statement inside, but even inside doesn't really exist at some level from the metric.
Right. So in a very basic sense, actually, string theory is not really defined on this background, per se, because this is going to begin at something, and we don't know what that something is. We don't have a conventional notion of an S matrix. What are we actually defining here? We have one end where we can compute things, and then we go to an end where we don't really know what's going on. That's really the status. And this is what we get by naive interpolation of the metric using standard formula.
So how do you compute correction for the metric?
You mean in this setup? We're going to take the approach that this is the metric as given with a naive lift, and not worry about computing any corrections directly in space-time. You can certainly try and do it in the weak coupling approach by seeing whether it's renormalized alpha prime, renormalizing G string. I think in each case you'll find that all the corrections vanish at weak coupling. Oops, I had these ordered the wrong way. Okay. So we need another approach. How are we doing, actually? The time. Okay. So we'll start the other approach and then perhaps break. I think the fair statement is there should be some definition of string theory in this background. So we need some other means of actually finding that definition and seeing what's going on. Okay, so this brings us to the matrix Big Bang. And I'm just going to start by reviewing very briefly sort of this idea of matrix theory in flat space. Due to these authors, Banks, Fisher, Schenker, and Susskind. So, their idea was to describe M theory or string theory in the discrete light cone quantization, in this DLCQ quantization, which goes as follows. If we start with flat 11 dimensions, say for M theory, We can consider physics in the sector in which we've periodically identified x minus. We specify the amount of momentum we put on this x minus circle and ask ourselves whether we can describe the dynamics of these degrees of freedom. And Seiberg provided a very nice argument explaining why you might be able to do this in a simple way, which goes as follows. I'll review it because it doesn't work for us. And I'll tell you how we have to kind of modify it. He said, instead of starting with the sector that's actually light-like compactified, let's make it slightly space-like compactified. Something like this. So this will go over in the limit that epsilon goes to 0 to an honest light-like compactification. And then the idea is that you perform a large boost. So you'll boost with a beta that's approaching 1. The beta is roughly, say, 1 minus epsilon squared. And by performing such a boost, you'll be rescaling your definition of x minus. That's in root 2. And x plus, oppositely, such that this almost light-like circle actually becomes space-like. So this actually gives you essentially a space-like compactification.
So it doesn't change the light. Does it say light-like
becomes space-like? Well, it's almost light-like. So it's just a little bit space-like. And then it becomes completely space-like. That's the argument. Right. It's not turning a light-like into a space-like per se. So there is a limiting procedure here, which is actually important for us, because it does involve this large boosting. Space-like compactification. Where, say, in terms of time and x, we are actually compactified on a very small circle, shrinking with a circle of size epsilon, which is getting very, very small. So here, just to make it clear, this is T. Okay. So if you started by considering some process in which the energies were order 1 initially, by making this large boost, you end up considering physics with energies of order epsilon. So the energies become very low, but you're just starting some physical scattering process. So you look at some graviton scattering process, you make this transformation, and in the new frame, you're starting a very low energy scattering process, which effectively means that your Planck scale, if you were to rescale variables, has gotten effectively very big. And so all of the effects of that we don't understand in M-theory get pushed off into this ever-increasing M Planck. But we are studying physics on a very small circle, so we should reduce the string theory. When we reduce the string theory on this circle, which gives us a theory in which G string is also getting very small, so it will be perturbative once we've rescaled these parameters, and the string scale is getting very big. So this is a theory of n d0 brains, which arise from the momentum we put on this circle, in a limit in which open string oscillators and gravitons and gravity have decoupled. And this was the idea. So now it's reduced to some effective matrix quantum mechanics that you can study directly. You can give to, you know, in your quantum mechanics class, if you want to torture your students, have them study it, and that should define for us the physics of our original scattering process. This is kind of a very quick introduction to matrix theory. Okay. So, Maybe we should pause here, and then
okay.
Part two, we'll be applying this to the cosmological background.
Yeah, let's take 10 minutes.